Back at a new week here on Connecticut Today for Monday, April 13th. We played part of a conference call that involved, among others, Governors Ned Lamont of Connecticut, Andrew Cuomo of New York, and Phil Murphy of New Jersey on how the tri-state area and the Northeast will reopen for business again after the coronavirus. Also joining us, Mark Fitch of the Yankee Institute on whether or not Connecticut will delay raises for state employees during COVID-19. As usual, 4 o'clock hour, we aired a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's daily COVID-19 virus briefing. At 4:30, we talked to a critic of the World Health Organization, spotlight now on the WHO, amid allegations it was not honest with the world about COVID-19. And joining us to close out the show in the 5 o'clock hour, former Republican State Senator Joe Markley of Southington. He has an op-ed in the Connecticut Mirror about what's facing the General Assembly when they finally go into special session.
Each state is going to name a public health official for that state, an economic development official for that state. Those officials and the chief of staff of the governor of each state will then form a working group that will start work immediately on designing a reopening plan, taking into consideration the public health concerns and issues and the economic reactivation issues and concerns, study the data, study the research, study the experience of other countries, and give us guidelines and parameters to go forward. Again, we anticipate different facts, different circumstances for different states, different parts of states, but let's be smart and let's be cooperative and let's learn from one another. And that is inarguable. With that, let me turn it over to Governor Phil Murphy. Governor Murphy, thank you so much for being with us.
Governor Cuomo, thank you for hosting us so graciously. And in the category of you're known by the company you keep, I'm honored to be with you and Governor Lamont, Governor Wolf, Governor Carney, Governor Raimondo in this discussion and in this initiative. You know, just as we harmonized as states, you know, New Jersey's the densest state in America, and we're in that corridor that is so unique. And it was imperative to not just do the things that we needed to do within our four walls as we closed our state down, but to do it in close coordination with New York and Pennsylvania and Delaware, Connecticut, especially. And it's that same spirit that we're coming together and acknowledging as we, whenever it is, and by the way, we have not yet plateaued. We're a couple of beats behind New York. Our positive tests have begun to flatten, but we're not yet there. But as we, you know, whenever it is that we determine based on the facts, the data, the science, that it is safe for us to responsibly begin the reopening and all the healthcare infrastructure that goes with that, to do that in coordination seems to be an overwhelmingly prudent approach. And we're honored to be very much a part of this group. We do know this, that an economic recovery only occurs on the back of a complete healthcare recovery. And that order is essential. And getting that wrong, transposing those steps or jumping in too early or maybe jumping in by ourselves. Governor Cuomo and I have talked about if the protocols on one side of the Hudson for a restaurant or a bar are different than the other, or similarly across the Delaware, you could have inadvertent, unintended consequences which could be grave. So getting this right, both the timing, the infrastructure, from as well as input, as Governor Cuomo has said, from both healthcare experts as well as economic development experts, in addition to our government colleagues, seems to me and to us to be an incredibly smart way to go. This is the fight of our lives. Let there be no doubt about it. And we're not out of the woods yet. And reopening ourselves back up will be equally challenging, beyond the shadow of a doubt. So I'm honored to be with my fellow governors, as I have been every step of the way over the past several months, and look forward to that spirit and coordination going forward. Thanks, Governor Cuomo.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Governor Murphy, and you're right. We started this journey together. We're going to end it together on a positive note. Same with Governor Ned Lamont from the state of Connecticut. Governor Lamont, thank you very much. Thank you for being with us.
Andrew, thanks for getting us organized and everybody here. I'll just pick up where Phil left off. He mentioned the major transportation corridors that interconnect at least New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut as part of a tri-state workforce. And we all slowly closed down methodically parts of our economy in a way that we tried to mitigate the effects of the contagion. And we're going to be thoughtful about how we get this opened as well. But, you know, Governor Cuomo, as you know, all of our pandemic here in Connecticut is all along that I-95 Metro North corridor, where we have hundreds of thousands of people going back and forth between New York and Connecticut. It's the commuter corridor for us, but it's also the COVID corridor, which is why it's so important that we work together thoughtfully on this. Listen to the experts, as you say, and make sure you don't pull the trigger too early. I'm looking over at Japan and Hong Kong and Singapore. And those places are unfortunately seeing a small resurgence, the second half of the V coming back again. And that would be so demoralizing for our economy. So that's why what we do, I want to do on a coordinated basis, have a database that we share, establish the same protocols so we know how we're working together, and get that information up to or down to Washington so they can coordinate as well. I mean, we're going to be thinking about the mix of PCR antigens and probably the low infection areas in terms of testing, and probably the antibody testing in those areas where it's more prevalent, so we can put together a system that allows our people to get back to work. And I couldn't agree with each and every one of you that working together makes the most sense, listening to the experts, doing this methodically, but doing it now. Back to you, Governor Cuomo.
I wanted to bring on now our buddy Mark Fitch, who writes the Fitch Files column in the Yankee Institute. And Mark had an interesting posting a couple of days ago. Mark, first of all, how are you? How are you holding up in this whole thing?
Oh, you know, I'm probably like everybody else, maybe going a little stir crazy, staying in the house all day. But, you know, I'm hanging in there.
Yeah, you had posted something interesting that, you know, this I think kind of maybe goes in the only in Connecticut thing here, but you posted something that a lot of people are looking at here in how other governors in the area are handling things vis-a-vis paying their state employees versus what's going on here. Explain that to the listeners, Mark. What's going on? What'd you find out?
Well, you know, Connecticut is scheduled in July to do a second round of pay increases for state employees. That's going to tally up to about $353 million in, you know, spending. Other governors are kind of hitting the pause button on that in their own states, including Governor Cuomo in New York. He issued a 90-day kind of suspension of a 2% employee increase, state employee increase in pay. And the governor down in Virginia, he also hit the pause button on wage increases. And the governor in Pennsylvania, you know, is essentially just furloughed without pay about 9,000 state employees that were deemed non-essential. And because all the governors are waiting to see how this is going to play out when it comes to state finances, because this is a big, fast shock to the system, to, you know, the financial system, to the economy. We have hundreds of thousands of people out of work. We have thousands of businesses closed down. And moving forward, we don't know what that's going to look like in the state budget. So, you know, Connecticut is currently under contract for these pay increases in July. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not that's going to continue, and it also remains to be seen what we're looking at as far as budget deficits going into this new fiscal year. So it's a lot of moving parts, and you know, Connecticut could be looking at a big loss when it comes to tax revenue and a big increase in costs related to Medicaid and unemployment and everything else.
A couple of more minutes with our buddy Mark Fitch joining us from the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. Mark and his Fitch Files was able to shine light on something that a lot of you folks may not have realized, the fact that while other Democratic governors and in some other states are calling a timeout here for state employee raises just to see where they stand after the COVID-19 outbreak. Apparently, those races are going through here in Connecticut, we think. Mark, do you know, and I don't know whether you would know this or not, is there any language in the CBAC agreement, maybe in fine print or whatever, that would allow Governor Lamont or any Connecticut governor to call a timeout on those races or not?
Oh, no, he can do it. He, you know, with the emergency powers, he can suspend regulations and legislation. And the contracts that were contained in the 2017 CBAC agreement were approved legislatively. So he should be able to do that. And, you know, frankly, you know, when you're talking about, you know, 220,000 people filing for unemployment in Connecticut, maybe the timing of, you know, doing these raises when we don't know what the impact is going to be, you know, might not be great. Now, you know, obviously there are a lot of state employees who are working very hard in the face of this crisis. You know, you have, you know, some first responders. You know, we, you know, Connecticut does have hospitals where there are doctors and nurses. You have Department of Correction, Department of Labor is clearly working overtime trying to process these unemployment claims. But when it comes down to it, you know, we don't know what the money situation is going to be like. And so asking a, you know, doing a, you know, a temporary suspension, as all these executive orders are, they're all temporary.
Yeah.
Is probably not asking too much, because the legislation is still in place. It's just kind of hitting the pause button until you find out what are we looking at here? Because Connecticut taxpayers are going to be paying for the economic and fiscal effects of this pandemic for years to come.
Yeah, I mean, you're not saying don't give them the money. I don't think anybody here is saying that, Mark. But as I think the governor or maybe Kevin Limbaugh or somebody or Melissa McCall said a couple of weeks ago, we're looking at, just because of the lack of tax revenue here, Mark, we're looking at, what, at least a $500 or $600 million at least budget deficit after this whole thing clears out, if it ever does clear out.
That's just for this year. Next year, they're thinking possibly $1.5 billion. So, and that's, you know, you're talking fiscal years. So you're talking, you know, in July. So, yeah, I mean, you do kind of have to see what cards you're playing here before you start giving things away. And yeah, the contract was set. It was approved legislatively. There's no real changing it unless the unions want to reopen the agreements, which I doubt that they do. Mm-hmm. But the governor can do temporary suspension of legislation. So, it's not permanent. It's temporary, but kind of waiting to see how is this going to affect Connecticut's budget and how are they going to fix that budget.
Why do you think he didn't call for that? Is there a little fear of upsetting the unions, or do you think he is genuinely, you know, a little queasy about maybe this being read the wrong way by some of the state employees?
I think it could be read the wrong way. Obviously, you have a lot of state employees who are working hard, and he doesn't want to seem unappreciative, but also it's not scheduled to kick in until July, so maybe they're hoping that the crisis passes by then, or that they'll have a better idea before he issues some kind of executive order. I mean, in the case of New York, Andrew Cuomo suspended the pay increases for 90 days, but those pay increases were set to go in essentially this week. So he waited right up until the last minute and said, all right, we can't do this yet. So it might just be a timing issue. It's July. It's several, you know, a couple months off. And so it's one of those things where, well, we don't have to deal with it right now. We'll deal with it down the road.
Have you gotten any sort of response on your piece from the governor's office yet? Has Max Reese or anybody reached out to you or not?
No. We just published it today. So,
okay.
And clearly the governor's been busy. He was just doing an announcement with several other governors regarding trying to figure out when they can start reopening businesses in the region.
And we'll have your boss on, Carol, tomorrow to talk about that, all right?
Exactly.
All right. All right. What do you have any, from what he just said, I don't know whether you heard any of it. Any thoughts you have, Mark, on this whole process of reopening things? Because I got to tell you, and I said earlier in the show today, I don't care whether it's on a local level, like a mayor or a governor on the state level or a president, this is a very antsy thing to have to, you know, decide and really pull the trigger on.
Yeah, well, last week, Yankee Institute sent out a press release calling for a task force in the state to examine how to reopen the state when the time is right. Now, we're clearly not medical experts, and we're not saying that the time to open is now. But sooner or later, you know, things are going to have to reopen, and you need to have a plan in place for how to do that in a safe, effective manner. And you have to have businesses at the table, you know, who know what the needs, you know, what their needs are. You have to have business representatives at the table who know, you know, how businesses can reopen in the best way and what support that they'll need from the state. So, yes, you know, we should at least have a plan for when the time is right, according to medical experts, that we can start to reopen the state, how that's going to be done. Is it going to be done in phases? You know, is it going to be done, you know, certain retail outlets as opposed to others? Because right now it seems like they're starting to get the idea that they need a plan in place. And, you know, we encourage the state of Connecticut to convene its own task force to do that and to know the best way to move forward with this. Because sometimes relying on a place like New York, who has a major issue with New York City and the number of cases that they're experiencing down there, they might not be able to reopen for a longer period of time than, say, Connecticut. So there's different, you know, each state has different and unique needs. And, you know, we should be focused on what's best for our state and how to best get people, you know, back to work when the time is right.
All right, Mark, thanks, and we'll check in with your boss, Carol, tomorrow on that, about 3:30 here on the show. Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Mark, as always, thank you. We appreciate the time. Take care.
Thank you, Paul.
Storm, wind and rain. And just quick update, there are about 40,000 folks without electricity, mainly in the Eversource area. It's sort of spread around Westport, Plainfield, New Milford. And go to my Twitter handle, at GovNedLamont, and you'll be able to get all the information in terms of when your community looks like they may get their power back on time. But, you know, shout out in these really tough times for these utility folks who are out there on the ground in the pouring rain doing whatever they can to help get the power back up. Thanks, guys. Let me give you a quick update again on our COVID daily summary. We haven't done this in a few days. Just very quickly, you see the numbers are jumping around a little bit, but the positive cases are up from yesterday, and that's because the tests are up from yesterday. Nothing striking there. The deaths are down a little bit, thankfully, but not a trend makes. I think the most hopeful thing that I see as you look at these numbers, again, is the hospitalization is not going up exponentially, which means our hospitals have a better chance to keep this under control. Again, you can see that while the hospitalizations are not going down, they're not going up faster, and I got to give a shout out. We've got the ventilators, we're keeping up with the PPE, we've got the beds, so we're able to manage this thanks to our amazing hospitals working together as one big system, being able to take care of folks in need. Next up. This is a chart that we've done a few times before. I think it says a couple of things. One, the top line there is Fairfield County. Well, Fairfield County went up a little bit in the last day. That's in part because Bridgeport has a big surge in infections and hospitalizations. Overall, you can see the line Fairfield County, which is where the pandemic hit first in Connecticut, is flattening out a little bit. Don't get too casual. You'll see that New Haven is still going up, but they have good capacity there, Yale New Haven Hospital. So we're well taken care of there. And Hartford still continues to go up in a consistent way, but not an exponential way. I want to spend a little more time on this chart, if I could. I just think it's relevant, especially given the fact that we just announced a partnership with most of our regional governors here in the Northeast, including New York and Andrew Cuomo and Phil Murphy in New Jersey. And you say, why do you need this partnership? Because we worked together when it came to how we were going to slowly close things down and do everything we could with social distancing to limit the spread of the virus. And so far, it looks like that social distancing is working. And it also makes sense if Cuomo is going to open his bars and restaurants at some point indeterminate in the future, we should probably be on the same path as New York and vice versa, I might say. That said, I understand that, look, all parts of the state in this region are very different, and we're going to act on our own. And that's what this chart tells you a little bit. It shows you that Connecticut, our statewide infection, is about one-third what it is in the New York City area, and about one-half of what it is in New Jersey. So as we put together our partnership, we've got a new advisory group I'm about to announce. This gives you some indication of how we think about these different regions. Again, you can see that Fairfield County is maybe half of what New York is, and then New Haven and Hartford a little bit less accordingly. I think New Haven and Hartford less than Fairfield because, A, we did the social distancing earlier there, relatively speaking. I'd like to think that is catching on. And secondly, it's just worth thinking about Fairfield County, New Haven, and Hartford County, all part of that I-95 Metro North Corridor. And that's the other reason that I got together with my fellow governors, because we all share the same tri-state workforce. And we had Phil Murphy from New Jersey on the line, and all of his infections are in the greater New York City area as well. And for Cuomo, they're all moving out in the Long Island. So what we're all trying to do is celebrate the fact that our social distancing is maybe beginning to work. Let's say we're a week or so behind New York in terms of the effects of that, but also meant we are a week or so ahead of New York in getting our social distancing in place. And that also means that we have a better opportunity to make a difference in the future. I'd just like to say, maybe go back to that last graph if you could. What we're trying to do is deal with the public health crisis that is ongoing and continuing. I think you could see that from the lines as they continue to go up. At the same time, we think about the future, and we think about getting our state back to work in a thoughtful way that keeps us safe. And I am cautious when I say that because I see what's going on in Singapore and Hong Kong and Japan. We've been able to learn first time around when they first got into that, and now second time around is maybe they pulled back a little bit on the social distancing too soon, and you'll see the rate of infections going up in those same Asian countries where they were a few months ahead of us early on. You'll see that in Singapore, for example, infections are up 50%, and they've had to put in place much stricter social distancing a second time around. And that's no good for us. That's no good for the economy. That's no good for giving people hope. That's no good for getting this economy going again. You know, I think we went down, and we're going to steadily go back up. But what I don't want to do is down and back up and then down again. And that's what I was talking about with my fellow governors. We think about a thoughtful way that we go about getting our state back to work. Look, I can tell you that you can see, if you remember from some of the other charts, that New London County and Litchfield County and Tolland, you know, are much lower in terms of infection rate. And there, that's no reason to get complacent. That means that if we continue to go with our molecular testing, the testing that determines whether or not you're afflicted with COVID, we can get you quarantined and make sure the infection does not expand throughout those counties. We can do a much better job of keeping the infection rate low and allowing people to get back to work sooner. And it could be that in a place like Fairfield County, where the infection rate is not nearly what it is in, say, New York City, but is still dramatically higher than it is in the rest of the state, that there we'll focus on the antibody testing. That's the blood test. That's the test that says whether or not you've been infected by COVID and whether or not you maybe built up some of the antibodies that would mean you're more likely to be able to get back to work first. So that's what I'm working on with my fellow governors. And we also are going to be thinking about what are the communities that we target when we think about this testing. You know, the obvious one, is, of course, is our first responders, starting with our nurses and docs. God bless you, making sure you're safe, maybe making sure that you can get to work and stay at work and know that you're COVID-free. I think also about our most vulnerable populations. We've talked a lot about our folks in the nursing homes and do a better job of testing there. And Josh will be able to answer questions further about what we're doing and making sure you're quarantined in those nursing homes. And also we're opening up COVID-only nursing homes. And that would be a second priority for our testing. And I also think a lot about our big manufacturing facilities. A little distress that Electric Boat has had a fair number of infections over the last few days. Good news is that Kevin Rainey, the president, is now free and clear because he had been infected as well. What they're doing in terms of separating out the different shifts, they got the blue shift and the gold shift, I think it is, with a break in between so they can clean everything down. They're ramping up on the thermometers, ramping up on the testing. Those are areas, again, where I want to focus our testing. And that's what I'm collaborating with my fellow governors, but more importantly, what we're doing ourselves. And there I'd like to just take a minute to announce that we're going to have a reopened Connecticut advisory board. And this is made up of the best and the brightest around the state, business as well as science. One familiar name is going to be co-chairperson of that board. That's Indra Nooyi. Indra, as you know, is also helping take the lead in our economic development efforts. And CT Advantage and what that means. Her co-pilot is Dr. Albert Koh. He's our Dr. Fauci, so to speak. He is Yale's leading epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist. And they were going to put together a collection of folks from business and science with a focus on health outcomes, analytics, clinical lab work, mobile technology. So we have exactly in place what we need when we think about the molecular testing, the antibody testing, the broad-based testing. What are our priorities as we try and think about getting people back to work safely sooner rather than later? And those are all the protocols. That's all the data that we're going to be sharing on a regional basis with my fellow governors. And more importantly, or just as importantly, sharing on a national basis. We talked to Dr. Birx about that just this morning. And she's really urging other states to follow the lead of the Northeast states to do a better job of making sure that information comes to them. We're going to be announcing the rest of the advisory board over the next couple of days. I can tell you that we have Connecticut's very own Scott Gottlieb as a senior advisor to this group. Scott, you probably remember, was recently head of the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, in the Trump administration. And also Zeke Emanuel, who maybe you know is a healthcare expert, currently a University of Pennsylvania professor, and before that, healthcare in the Obama administration. I'll just tell you a few other things that I'm thinking about right now is our protective gear. I've got some good news. Right now, the ventilator situation seems to be opening up. The feds are getting a lot of ventilators. We're receiving some ventilators. And I have right now a high degree of confidence that if we keep to our social distancing, nobody is going to be denied a ventilator who needs it. And that's extraordinarily good news. We were able to distribute our N95 masks. We got a couple hundred thousand out to about 70 of our municipalities. They, in turn, get out to the nursing homes. They get out to other first responders, as well as hospitals. And I like to think that for the near term, meaning the next week or so, we ought to be able to manage our need for a mask, N95 masks and the such. But I'm tired of just complaining about getting product from the Chinese, complaining about getting product from the national stockpile. I've said before, I think increasingly we're going to be on our own, and we ought to figure out what we're going to do. And with that, I can tell you that our administration worked closely communicating with Battelle, which has the only FDA-approved sanitizing, recycling equipment out there. We're going to be one of the very first states in the country installed this week the Battelle sanitizer. What that means is we'll be able to take up to 80 or 90,000 N95 and other face masks on a daily basis, get them sanitized, FDA approved, and back available to people. And that's important for our first responders. That's important for manufacturing. And over time, we've got hundreds of thousands of additional masks that are scheduled to come any day. You've heard that from me before. So we'll be able to expand the orbit of people who are able to get back to work because they'll have the necessary facial protection. Obviously, grocers and food service workers at the top of that list. And other small business, once we have that supply and we can count upon it. I'll just leave you with one story because this meant a lot to me. This is, I think, relatively good news, and I've heard this from our fellow governors as well. And this is true in Louisiana. This is true in Detroit. This is true in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts. We hope the curve is not bending down. We have a way to go there, but we hope we can manage in terms of capacity what we need to do. That's in small part because we're getting more of the PPE that you need. It's also in large part because you're maintaining your discipline when it comes to the social distancing. And I know there's a lot of anxiety and maybe we can rush back and stop shutting us down and it's soon gonna be spring. And I just wanted to give you highlights of a great story. I still read the sports pages, although there's not much new in the sports pages these days. But there was this Sunday in the Hartford Courant, and it's an article called No Staying at Home, the opposite of Stay Safe, Stay at Home. And it's a story about the Spanish flu when it came to Connecticut in 1918. And the headline on September 21st, 1918 said, "The Spanish grip," that's what they called the Spanish flu, "has spread over the city. Estimated there are 500 cases that now are being treated in Hartford." 500 cases. They're warning people to be careful. But that very same day on the sports page of the Hartford Courant, it said Babe Ruth in Sunday game in Hartford. And they had already won the World Series. Babe Ruth was then with the Boston Red Sox. And they were doing a sort of an all-star cast. And they came back. And a few days later, 5,000 fans showed up at the Hartford baseball grounds, and they're all taking the trolleys there and cheering their hearts out for Babe Ruth in this game. And as you can imagine, the stay safe, stay at home mantra failed in Hartford, and they went from having 500 people that looked like they were afflicted to 5,000 flu-related deaths in the greater Hartford area and 9,000 deaths in Connecticut over the course of the next 12 months. 9,000 deaths. That's 1% of the Connecticut population. 1% of the Connecticut population today is 30,000. 30,000. That's not going to happen. We're not going to let that happen. But I know the temptation for the next Babe Ruth, the next fun thing that's coming on, the next sunny day, everybody's going to want to get out and let it rip. And I just got to urge you any way I can. On a rainy day, this is easy. And I know your temptation to get the businesses going as soon as we can. I guarantee you, I know more than in my heart, we're going to do everything we can to get these businesses open. We're planning about that every day. But in the meantime, I've got to urge you, I've got to remind you, I've got to tell you, maintain the social distancing. That's how we'll be safe, and that's how we'll get this economy going again.
The World Health Organization, you probably heard of them, the WHO, affiliated with the UN, although you're hearing a lot about them right now, and a lot of people want them in both parties held to account because, and we'll eventually find this out, when did they know about the coronavirus? How much did they know? When did they know? And all those kind of Watergate era questions, all kinds of finger pointing right now. Did they keep their mouths shut about this under a threat from China, even though other nations were raising the red flag about this? Well, this is going to be a big political hot football coming up. And joining us right now is the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Tim Andrews is on the phone. Tim, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you today, sir?
I'm well, thank you, Paul. Well as can be expected given these difficult times, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I wanted to have you on the show, Tim, because, you know, it's just revving up, I think, the questions that people are going to have here, I think from both sides of the aisle, really, about the World Health Organization, a UN arm that, I guess, Tim, is supposed to look out for world health, supposed to be unbiased in the information it gives out, but it does use taxpayer money. I think, Tim, our contribution to the WHO was, what, $300-400 million a year, something like that?
Yes, something like that, exactly.
And your organization is taking an interest in this. Why, Tim?
So we've been following the World Health Organization for a number of years now because we've been looking at how they take our tax dollars and at the waste and the corruption and the abuse that you have seen endemic throughout the organization. We have seen a history of failure, a history of mismanagement, and this has really hit critical level when over the last couple of months we have seen that they refused to do the one job they were meant to do, which was prepare for global health emergencies and pandemics, and instead they were simply acting as a spokesperson and a PR agent for the Chinese Communist Party. And as a result of their failures and their defending and covering up Chinese Communist Party actions, this emergency has spread throughout the world in a way that could have been preventable or at least managed.
We continue on Connecticut Today at 4:41, 19 before 5 on a Monday with Tim Andrews, Executive Director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Why? Well, hundreds of millions of dollars a year of American taxpayer money goes to fund the World Health Organization, a group now that's really had the screws turned up on them and the spotlights turned up on them because of what they did or didn't do in this whole coronavirus thing. Now, Tim, you were telling us before we had to take the break there that the WHO, even before this whole coronavirus mess, does not necessarily have a stellar history.
That's correct. I mean, we saw the same thing happened previously when Ebola broke out in Africa, and leaked emails came out months after the fact that the World Health Organization declaring a public health emergency and alerting the world because they were thought that various African political leaders would get upset that it would hurt tourism. So all of these internal emails came out that they tried for months to bury the Ebola outbreak, and as a result, thousands of people needlessly died. And this was purely done on a matter of politics. In the same way as now, because of political pressure from Beijing, they refused for weeks and weeks to declare it a public health emergency. They put out statements saying it's not true that humans can get COVID-19 from animals, which we now know is a lie. They waited months, before they sent their first advance team. They said the travel restrictions were racist, and they helped to do. And the worst thing is, when China was arresting journalists, was arresting doctors who tried to speak out, the World Health Organization praised the Chinese Communist Party for, quote, leadership and transparency. So this is a pattern of abuse, and it's a pattern of an organization that cares more about luxury travel, where they spend $1,000 a night on hotel rooms, first-class flights, where they spend $200 million a year just on travel, more than they did on hepatitis, malaria, tuberculosis, and AIDS combined. This is an organization that simply cares about themselves and having their snouts in the trough rather than actually doing anything about global health.
So, Tim, is this something, and you've told me this, I've read about this now increasingly over the past couple of weeks, why is this allowed to continue? Simple question, why?
Because there's no accountability, because there's no transparency, because most people don't know what's going on. In terms of what's happening at the moment, China was very smart in that they donated a lot of money to African countries to get their votes so that their candidate and Dr. Tedros was their candidate. And you know it was his their candidate because the very first thing he did on getting elected was saying that Taiwan will never, ever, ever be part of the WHO. So the Chinese seem to just buy up all of the votes from small countries, and they install their puppets into these regimes, and you can't vote them out. You can't do anything about it. There's no accountability. And unfortunately, no one is willing to ask the hard questions and defund them, because if you say, well, you need to put financial pressure on them, people, before now at least, would simply say, why are you against health? And of course, everyone is in favor of health. The problem is that this isn't an organization that does anything to promote global health.
Tim, we're getting rumblings today, and I'm already seeing the articles. Oh, no, he can't do that. It's the wrong thing. As you say, it's about health. Don't do that. That President Trump is saber-rattling a little bit here, saying, listen, I may just put a hold on all American money that goes to the WHO, at least till they clean their act up. What do you think about that? What's your organization's position on that?
Look, that's definitely a step in the right direction. I mean, we need to stop subsidizing failure. If you want reform and you want the WHO to actually do its job, we need to stop rewarding their failures. We need to say, unless you have structural reform, then we're going to work with other groups, we're going to work with other countries that will be more effective, and they'll get the job done at a better deal for taxpayers, because we're the ones paying for it.
So who can stop this now? I mean, if the president, let's say Mr. Trump, makes good on his threat, and he supposedly, Tim, you've probably seen the same things I have, he supposedly is going to say something about that this week. He said over the weekend, what do you suppose the reaction to that will be? Do you think it'll be bipartisan, or will there be the usual sniping in D.C.?
I hope this will be bipartisan, because this isn't a left or a right issue. This is a right and wrong issue. The fact that our money is being misused and isn't going to help the people who deserve it is something that shouldn't be a question for Republicans or Democrats. It's something we should all agree and we should all support. Now, whether or not people on the other side of the aisle to the president will do the right thing and stand up for taxpayers and consumers, or if they're just going to use this to attack him and engage in political grandstanding, I hope they'll do the right thing, but to be honest, I'm not that optimistic.
What would be the effect of people just saying, well, that's fine, you can have your own little organization and jet set around the world, Tim, but we're just not going to pay attention to what you say anymore? Is that one possibility?
I think that's what we should do. And we should work with other countries who share similar thoughts. And we've seen a lot of other countries come out similarly critical of the WHO, like Taiwan, Japan, a few other countries, Western countries have said similar comments. So we can work with good countries to fund doctors on the ground. And the WHO can use their Chinese Communist Party money to keep promoting their propaganda and to go and travel on conferences. We just don't have to pay for it anymore.
And I could see, Tim, I mean, obviously you can't, I don't think China could, although, you know, the Chinese government, not the people, but the government, they will try everything they can. But how could they possibly stop other nations from, you know, forming another group outside of the UN, the holy halo of the UN, to do the same thing? It would probably drive Xi Jinping and his masters there in Beijing crazy.
It probably would, but it'll be the right thing to do for our taxpayers.
Tim, finally, tell us a little bit about the Taxpayers Protection Alliance and what folks need to know about them and where they can get information.
Absolutely. So you can look us up at www.protectingtaxpayers.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, other social medias. So Twitter at Protect Taxpayers. And you can find information where we're out there fighting for taxpayers and consumers. So this is one project of ours where we're looking at international governmental organizations. And you can look at that through igowatch.org. But on our main website, you can see us standing up for taxpayers against all the special interest groups who want our tax dollars for their own pet projects. So we're a watchdog and a voice to stand up for taxpayers and consumers across the country.
And Tim Andrews, thank you, the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Stay safe, stay healthy, and hopefully we will speak in the future. Thank you, Tim Andrews. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Next gentleman, I've known him for years. He's been on the show here several times. Former Southington Republican state senator, ran for lieutenant governor last time around. He has a has an interesting op-ed today. Check it out. It came out in the Connecticut Mirror. The title is "When They Return, State Lawmakers Will Face a Great Test." And here to go into that is Joe Markley. Joe, I hope you are well in this time. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, and I'm doing very well, actually. I almost feel guilty about it. You know, when I was a younger man, I always thought someday I'll end up under house arrest when the Soviets take over. But that I'm one person that could put up with it, and it hasn't been too bad for me. I'm still able to work part-time for Companions and Homemakers, who I've been working with since I left office. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of reading and so forth, and it hasn't been too bad. And my heart goes out to the people that are suffering with it, though.
Yeah, Joe, you know, you're not in the General Assembly anymore, but you were there twice. Few people know how that place works as well as you do. I had a call earlier today, Joe, and was kind of surreptitious with you coming on, and had a very passionate caller who said, hey, you know, the governor is going to do this, and he's going to do that, and he's making all these decisions, and technically, you know, government still goes on, but, you know, there's nothing really going on in Hartford. We have an election coming up. You know, who's minding the story here? And then I see your article today. You urge what the focus should be if and when the General Assembly gets back in gear. Joe, how do you view this from all the years you've been involved in local and state politics? Because we still do we not have to have some sort of, even in times like this, Joe, you know, we have continuity of government on the national scale in case of a nuke or, yes, those Soviets come over. Do we have that here in the state right now or not?
Well, I guess I'd say no. And it's a natural thing that in a crisis, the executive branch steps up because they're in a position to make immediate decisions. So when the storm comes, the legislature doesn't have to go back into session to decide whether we're plowing the streets or shutting down the roads or anything. The governor does that. And the trouble with it is that, first of all, these crises become an excuse for the executive branch to take more power. And over the years at the federal level, the growth in the presidential power has been at times of crisis, at the Civil War, the Depression, World War II, whatever. And somehow they take the power, but they never really give it back. And I think sometimes the legislative branch is almost just as happy. I feel like in recent years at the international level, the president has run foreign policy and Congress has kind of just let the president do what he wanted to do. This is what we've got right now at the federal and the state level with this virus. So the president is taking the lead. Congress may criticize him, but they haven't really done anything to rein him in, nor do they even see that as being their job. Mm-hmm. In Connecticut, there's been less criticism. But the executive branch has shown the way. And my point is, what's the legislature going to do when it does come back? Mm-hmm. I don't know that there's anything they can do right now Len Fasano started to say maybe the governor's gone too far with this shutdown until May 20th. And I tend to agree with that. I don't think it's necessary right now to make a decision that far down the road. But the legislature is not going to go back into session and say, oh, no, you don't. Yeah. But they are going to go back in at some point this summer. They have to make budget adjustments. And what worries me at that point is the budget adjustments are one thing, and it's necessary. I might not like exactly how they do it, but I understand that it has to be done. But what I'm hoping is that they confine themselves to just those essential things and that they don't attempt in what would be a one-day session to take up a bunch of bills that can be put off until next year when they can be properly vetted.
A few more minutes here with Joe Markley, former Southington State Senator for two runs and Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor. Joe's got an op-ed here. It appears in the Connecticut Mirror. When they return, state lawmakers will face a great test. Joe, you say that there's only going to be 1 or 2 days worth of what probably will remain of a session because of this virus, but they have to adjust the budget. The folks on both sides of the aisle, Joe, conservatively, it looks now, they're going to be facing about $500 to $600 million in red ink this year because of a lack of a tax revenue, maybe $1 billion+ next year. In a $22 billion a year budget, Joe, that starts to poke the bear a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, the good thing is that we have a substantial rainy day fund at this moment. And unfortunately, it so often happens in life, just when you say, I've got a little set aside for an emergency, here comes the emergency. But they've got over $2 billion. And I have to say, I believe that by the time they go into a special session, which if I were guessing is going to be off in June or July, that $500,000 number is going to look small. I think we'll be lucky if the rainy day fund can take us to next year's session when we have to do the budget.
You're thinking it'll be well over $1 billion easily?
I'm not an expert on these things, but my goodness, think of what's going on in terms of sales tax receipts. It's got to be less than half of what would normally be happening. Mm-hmm. And income tax, the number of people that have become jobless, the number of people that are on reduced hours, the fall off in the stock market, it's going to have a tremendous effect on revenues. We can hope that when things are back to normal, first of all, that they're back to normal sooner rather than later, and that at that point there's pent up demand and it comes roaring back. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are going to be a little cautious after this is all over. I'm not sure that we're going to be rushing back into the restaurants and the theaters necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a tough situation. The special session, the general public has a misapprehension of a special session. They sometimes last for weeks or even months, but it doesn't mean the legislators are actually up there like they are during a normal session going through a committee process. What it means is they're waiting for a deal to be arrived at in a back room. This is, I don't even say this as a criticism, Paul. It's just the way it is. And at some point on this budget, the governor and legislative leaders, whoever else is in the room, will put something together. And then they'll call the legislators up and say, hey, Thursday, come in and we're going to vote.
Sure.
Okay, that's the way it's done. It's maybe not great, but I'm not complaining about it. What worries me is if they say, Thursday, we're going to vote on the budget. And, oh, by the way, we've swept up another 40 or 80 or 200 bills that didn't go through the normal process, and we're going to put them into one big omnibus bill, too, and we'll vote on that as long as we're there. And there'd be no real chance for public comment, no chance to organize opposition to anything, no chance to really focus on individual issues. And both the Speaker, Joe Arisimowitz, and the Senate President Martin Looney, and Will Haskell, the young senator from down in Fairfield County, have all said that something like that, some kind of big omnibus bill, is a possibility in a special session. And I think it's very dangerous. And I want to bring it up now so that people have a chance to say, please don't do it, because I have hopes that these leaders are more responsible than that.
Joe, how do you think Governor Lamont has handled this whole thing? You know, for a guy that really has never, well, was never really elected to anything. I know he had a small town seat, I think, in Greenwich once. He did win the Senate primary a few years ago, but we know how that ended up. For a guy that may, and maybe this has helped him, Joe, for a guy that's kind of a newbie at this, I think he's done a pretty good job.
Well, he's, you know, it always is an opportunity for the executive to look good. And I don't say that. I think Ned Lamont's a decent man. I'm quite convinced that he's doing the very best that he can. And I think it has been something that has made him, it's put him in the position of a leader, and the people have responded to it. I'm sure he's more popular today than he was before this all started. I don't, as I said earlier in this, I feel like the decision to extend this until May 20th may well have been premature. I think that some flexibility, we're a small state, but it's still a very different state from one section to another. Yeah. I'm not sure that the rules that we might need in Westport, for instance, where this is particularly severe, or in Stamford, are the same thing that we need to be doing in Pomfret or in Salisbury. And I think there's a little bit of a danger when you have the chance to be the leader of doing too much. And the other thing I'd say about it is one of the dangers is you don't get in trouble for doing too much. if he does lock down the state for a long period of time and the virus doesn't prove to be as bad as some people have projected down the road, you can say, well, it's because we acted decisively.
Yeah.
But there's going to be an economic cost. We all know that. And it's hard not to be worried about that as well.
Joe Markley, as always, great thoughts. Folks, check out his op-ed, the latest one that appears in the Connecticut Mirror. Joe, always good to hear from you. Stay safe, and we'll talk in a few weeks. Thank you.
You too, Paul. Thank you.